Karamani Samedi, I'm from Columbia University. Okay. And just a warning that you can read, this talk is much more practical in nature than the other talks, but from the bright side, it's only 30 minutes long. Okay, so what we do is create a method for taking any existing block cipher that works on the fixed size B-bit input, and we turn it into a block cipher that will work on a range of input sizes from anywhere in the range of B to 2B bits. We call the result an elastic block cipher. This allows applications to set the block size and also results in encryption being proportional to the block size computationally. Okay. Today, due to limited time, I'll just be going through one result of our security analysis, and that is how we relate the security of the elastic version of the cipher to the original version against practical attacks that attempt to recover the key bits. Okay. So first I'll explain why we were looking at this problem. And then I'll go through some previous approaches to it. I'll describe our algorithm and then one of our security results. Now, having a block cipher work on fixed size inputs makes it easier to design and implement them. But it doesn't match up with real world data. So when encrypting data as blocks, if the data is not an integral number of blocks long, padding is added to the end. So if I have 20 bytes and want to encrypt it with a 16 byte block cipher, 12 bytes of padding will be added. The ciphertext ends up being 32 bytes long instead of 20, and I incur the cost of two full applications of the block cipher. Now, ideally, I would like the ciphertext to be 20 bytes long and the workload to be maybe 1.25 times the applications of the block cipher. Okay. Now, if I have data that is a large number of blocks, say I'm encrypting files on a PC, support for variable size blocks doesn't offer a large benefit in terms of computation or space. But if I have applications that are encrypting a large quantity of fairly small segments of data, for example, in database applications and IP applications, then the padding can become a significant portion of overhead, and support for variable size blocks is useful. So, for example, these two tables are from a database benchmark for online bookstores. And I'll be using a 16-byte block cipher here to encrypt them. Now, the fields in black are those that are less than 16 bytes, and would be padded no matter what if I encrypt at the field level, or in one case, the field is exactly 16 bytes. The fields in purple are the ones I'm interested in because they are greater than 16 bytes, but are not an integral number of 16-byte blocks. Now, if I encrypt these at the row level, padding is just about 4% of the resulting ciphertext, so in that case, it's not a lot of overhead. But if I encrypt at the field level, the fields in purple, or the padding of the fields in purple, end up contributing to 17% of the ciphertext of the address table and produce 40% of the ciphertext of the customer table. So there it becomes a significant portion of overhead. Now, another reason we were looking at this is just the question of how to design a variable length block cipher such that there's provable security about practical attacks on the cipher and that the computational workload will be proportional to the block size was an open question. There have been previous proposals for variable length block ciphers, and they fall into two categories. Either designing something from scratch, which we wanted to avoid because it's very easy to overlook something and have security flaws in a cipher, as previous approaches did, or the approach of taking an existing cipher as a black box and applying it multiple times. And Belair and Rogoway have a solution where the variable length version can be defined in terms of the original cipher by treating the original cipher as a black box, and I'll show that construction on the next slide. And there was a modification to their construction suggested 2 years ago by Patel. And one more thing I want to mention, it's not a block cipher, but you can actually modify the modes of encryption, and it's called ciphertext stealing. You take the ciphertext from the next to last block when encrypting and use it to pad the last block, and then you don't have to output that ciphertext. This ends up preserving the length of the data, but it's computationally more work than padding because you still incur the full application of the block cipher on the last block, and how the last two blocks of the data are encrypted has to be tweaked, the modes not consistent, and when decrypting the data with ciphertext stealing, the last block has to be decrypted before the next to last block, which is inconvenient, especially with streaming data. Now, the black box approach that exists is by Belair and Rogoway. And here, D K subscript will denote the block cipher with key K1, K2, and K3 here. What they did was take a data that's not an integral number, a B bits long, and they add padding. Instead of padding the last block, they're going to pad the block right before that. They then encrypt the data in cipher block chaining mode, take the last block of ciphertext from there, and encrypt it again, and use that as the IV to the cipher in counter mode. Counter mode is then run until enough bits are output to XOR with the original data minus the last block, so the U here. Then the ciphertext is the IV concatenated with the result of that XOR. Now, the security of this can be defined in terms of the security of the original block cipher G. However, it's computationally inefficient. If I just want to encrypt 1 plus a fractional block, I have the B bit input here and the Y bits. There's 3 applications of the cipher using 2 different keys to get alpha and 1 more application to get enough bits to XOR with the Y bit portion. So I end up with 4 applications of the block cipher just to encrypt 1 plus a fractional block of data. That's at least twice the work of padding the data, and I need 3 keys. And furthermore, the workload is not proportional to the block size. If I encrypt B plus 1 bits, it's the same work as encrypting B plus B minus 1 bits. The modification suggested to this was to replace the CVC portion here with a hash function, and everything from here onward stays the same. In that case, I end up with 2 applications of the block cipher plus a hash function to encrypt B plus Y bits. So again, it's not computationally efficient compared to padding, and it's not, the workload is not proportional to the block size. Right. Now, we didn't want to design something from scratch, but we also didn't want to take the block cipher as a whole and use it, because then we can't gain computational efficiency. So what we end up doing is treating the round function of the block cipher as a black box. Right. Now, at a very high level, the block ciphers used in practice just take on this general structure. They're iterative, just the round function applied a series of times. And the key given to the block cipher is fed into a key schedule, which expands it to a longer bit string, and those bits are used as the keys to the individual rounds. So what we do is we keep the round function intact, and we're going to add steps between the round. Now, when describing my algorithm, I'll let G prime denote the elastic version of the cipher. G will denote the original block cipher. B is the block cipher G, and B plus Y will be the block cipher G prime. Right. Now, it's more involved in this, but the basic underlying structure that we use is as follows. And I want to point out this is not a FISTL network. I've had people occasionally look at this briefly and just say it's a FISTL network, and it's not, because of what bits are involved in the XOR here. What we do is we take the round function intact from the block cipher. It'll continue to map B bits to B bits. Y bits are left out. These Y bits are then XORed into the output of the round function, and that becomes the input to the next round, and the bits that came out of the round function involved in the XOR are swapped out. This results in every bit that just came out of the round function plus the bits that were left out, forming the input to the next round. Okay. Now, in addition to that, we add initial and end of round whitening. That's just XORing with key bits. It's a common step found in block ciphers. If G had whitening, it's expanded to cover all B plus Y bits. If it wasn't in G, it's added in. And then we add a key-dependent permutation at the beginning and the end. This is solely to prevent an attacker from knowing exactly which Y bits were left out of the first round function when decrypting or encrypting with polyability 1. And the number of rounds will be set based on the number of rounds of G denoted by R and the block size. And this results in every bit position becoming direct input to the round function at least the same number of times as it would in the original cipher. And this is needed in order to guarantee the diffusion rate stays the same. And a few notes in this algorithm. If my original network, my original block cipher was a FISTL network, we use the cycle from the FISTL network as the round function, and we're adding the whitening and swapping steps here between each cycle. So the cycle becomes our round function. Okay. Now, to decrypt, you have to have the inverse to the round function and then run it in reverse. For diffusion, every bit is going to impact at least the second through last rounds of G prime. Obviously, Y bits are left out of the first application in the round function. If it takes I rounds in G for every bit to impact every other bit, it will take at most I plus 1 rounds in G prime. So we can prove the rate of diffusion for G prime in terms of the rate of diffusion for G. For the key schedule, obviously G prime needs more keys than G. This is because we have the whitening added in, or it was expanded to cover all B+Y bits, and we have more rounds. Now, unlike the block ciphers where we could categorize them as a series of rounds, there's no way to categorize the key schedules found in practical block ciphers. And we didn't want to have to modify the key schedule of every single block cipher when we created the elastic version of it. So we decided to use a stream cipher for our key schedule so we could get as many bits as needed. Now, this has a couple benefits. First, we end up with a standard key schedule, and there's no reason not to have a standard key schedule across multiple block ciphers. And we end up with significantly more randomness in our expanded key bits compared to the key schedules of existing block ciphers. But on the downside, the key schedule ends up being slower than those of existing block ciphers. In our implementation, we used RC4, and it was running about eight times slower than AES's key schedule. Right. We created four implementations of this to illustrate that this works in general. We chose finalists from the AES and NESI competition just to have different types of structures as the round function. We measured the performance of the elastic version compared to padding the data. And we also applied the same statistical tests that NIST used in the AES competition to the elastic versions and original versions of these ciphers. And the elastic versions passed at a rate at least the same rate as the original cipher. So this indicates that there was no obvious flaw in our design. It's more of a sanity check. It doesn't mean that the ciphers are secure. Okay. So one example was with AES, and just to remind you what AES looks like is shown here. So we just take the round function and insert it into the structure. The white needs to expand it to cover all B+Y bits. And the last round, we continue to omit the one step as AES does. There's no need to add the swap step and exporting a bits here after the last round, so that's a minute. And then the number of rounds is set based on the number of rounds of AES plus the block size. Now, I won't dwell on performance, but I just want to point this out. Whether this has an actual performance benefit in practice depends on the actual cipher and the environment that you're in. There's two common ways of implementing AES in software. One way denoted by case 2 here is to collapse the round function into table lookups, and the round function is implemented with 4 32-bit table lookups and 5 XORs. That's a very efficient way to do it in software, but it requires a lot of memory. In that case, the time it took to encrypt 17-byte blocks, or 117-byte blocks, with the elastic version of AES, denoted by the green line here, starting right here, was the same time it took to encrypt them with padding. And this black line across the middle refers to the time it took to encrypt 100 of the blocks by padding them and using the fixed length version of AES. Now, the other way, common way of implementing AES in software is to keep the round function step separate and use a table lookup for just the mixed column step. In that case, there's a significant gain when encrypting bytes just over 16 bytes. I can encrypt 190 17-byte blocks with the elastic version of AES and the time it took to encrypt 100 such blocks by padding them. Okay. And the performance for the elastic versions of MISTI-1, Camilla, and RC6 generally followed this trend here, denoted by the purple and blue lines, with the cutover point varying. Okay. Now, in terms of security, we wanted to find a way to relate the security of the elastic version directly to that of the original cipher, because we didn't want to have to analyze each one of these against every known practical attack. Okay. So we're able to do that for key recovery attacks. In all concrete attacks, like linear differential cryptanalysis, attempt to recover the round key bits. And without loss of generality, I'm going to assume the attacks are recovering the round key bits, because if there existed an attack that recovered the original key, we could just plug it into the key schedule and have the round keys. Okay. Now, independent of this, we looked at linear and differential cryptanalysis in a little more detail, even though they are covered under our general result. Okay. Now, in general, I can say if there's an attack on G prime that finds the round keys, then there's an attack on G that will find the round keys for G, and it's polynomial time and memory related to the attack on G prime. Now, some assumptions here. First, assuming that if I can attack G prime in practice, I can attack a reduced round version of it. And that's generally true of ciphers in practice. I also assume the key schedule just takes the secret key and doesn't take the plain text or ciphertext as input, and that, again, is true of ciphers in practice. Now, there's various scenarios that need to be considered with this, and I just go through one in this presentation. This is the case where D did not contain whitening, in which case either attack D prime or a version of D prime without whitening, or if for some reason the attack on D prime has to include the whitening steps, then we end up finding a set of keys for D that are equivalent, meaning it will produce the same plaintext ciphertext pairs as those produced by G, but may not match G's key schedule. Okay. We also assume that the key bits used internal to the valence function can take on the same value in G prime as in G. If this is not true, then it's another case we consider, and it will end up, again, producing a set of equivalent keys that will map the plaintext to ciphertext but may not match G's key schedule. And we also don't use the initial and final key-dependent permutations, so this is just strengthens the argument here. Okay. Now, the reasoning behind this is because if you look at how the leftmost B bits of the data are processed in G prime, it's an instance of G, and if you collapse these steps, it just corresponds to whitening with different key bits. Okay. Now, there's two ways of converting the keys from G prime to G. The first method is just a very obvious, trivial observation. It's a direct conversion. And what it does is it ends up finding, if I have a set of M plaintext ciphertext pairs for D prime, it ends up finding keys that will correspond to a set of at most M plaintext ciphertext pairs for G. And it's useful when Y is small. Now, a second method will produce a set of round keys that will hold for N plaintext ciphertext pairs of G. Okay, but it takes more time than the first method. Okay. Method one is trivial, it's just a straightforward conversion. If the keys for the round function are going to be copied directly over to G, the whitening and swapping of bits are going to be collapsed, and if I just compute this, it just corresponds to XORing with different key bits in G. Okay. So to illustrate that, I have three blocks of data here. The data is 6 bits long, B is 4 bits, Y is 2 bits, and these are the whitening bits I find for D prime. And assume that this is the data coming out of the application of the valence function and the Y bits that were left out of the valence function. So I'm just going into the whitening stuff. So if I perform the whitening and swapping of bits, I end up with these data strings coming out. Well, if I collapse that just corresponds to XORing the leftmost B bits with the bits shown here. So what I would do is say, well, in this example, the whitening key bits I found for these whatever plaintext ciphertext pairs this corresponds to are identical. So I'm going to keep those in my set of plaintext ciphertext pairs, and this one's different, so I'm going to throw that out. Okay. And I'm going to proceed with converting the next round key for these two. Right. So in general, what we do is we run the attack on G prime and find the round keys. For the initial whitening in round one, we just discard the rightmost Y bits of the whitening and copy the rest over to G. Then from rounds 2 to R minus 1, we do the conversion round by round as shown on the previous slide. Now, in each round, this means I eliminate possibly 2 to the Y plaintext ciphertext pairs from my set. Okay. So each time I'm reducing the number of plaintext ciphertext pairs I have left from which I will find the keys. And the last round, this is in a swap step afterwards, we just discard the rightmost Y bits of the whitening and copy the key bits over. Okay. Now, this results in applying the attack on G prime one time. The time to convert the round keys is linear, and we will find keys that hold for a set of at least n over 2 to the y times r minus 2 plaintext ciphertext pairs for G. And it requires that y times r minus 2 be less than b. So it's only useful when y is small. Now, method 2, there are some preliminaries that I'm omitting here because of time. The first preliminary that I omit is the proof that if I have plaintext ciphertext pairs for G, I can form plaintext ciphertext pairs for G prime such that when I find the round keys for those, they will be consistent across any key bits used to process the leftmost B bits. Okay. And for now, I'm assuming that I have plaintext ciphertext pairs. There's a known plaintext ciphertext attack. This also works if I just have a known ciphertext attack on G prime. Okay. So now, instead of converting the round keys as I did before, conversion will mean the following. I'm going to just copy any key bits used internal to the round function from G prime over to G, And for the whitening steps, I'm just going to delete the rightmost Y bit for the whitening and copy the leftmost B bits over to G. Now, instead of finding the round keys all at once using the attack on G prime, I'm going to end up finding them round by round. And each time I do that, I will change the plain text that I use in G prime and apply the attack again to find the next round key. Okay. So I start out by finding the initial whitening denoted by round 0 here and any key bits used in the first round. And I convert them to the key bits for G by copying them over. I then run one round of encryption of G on each of the plain texts, take the output, use that as my new plain text, form a plain text for G prime, ciphertext stay the same, and repeat the process. And this time I'll be using a version of G prime without initial whitening. So then I find the next round key. That will be used for round key 2 of G, repeat the process, and continue on. Now, in the worst case, I have to apply G n times because I end up encrypting the plain texts round by round, and there's n of them. In worst case, I have to apply the attack on G prime R times. And each time, I reduce the number of rounds of G prime by one round. So I end up with order n R squared rounds of G prime being applied. Okay, so overall, it's polynomial time and memory work in the attack on G prime to find the key for G. A couple other notes. Independent of this, I said we looked at linear cryptanalysis in detail. Well, actually, we considered any algebraic type cryptanalysis where you just have equations relating to plaintext, ciphertext, and key bits. Now, because the steps in G prime between rounds are linear, if we have equations and we follow them through the rounds of G prime, we can actually convert them to equations for G. Now, doing the conversion may subtract some variables and it may add some variables, but it ends up that the number of variables it could potentially add is polynomial related to the number of rounds in G prime, and the equations will hold with the same probability that they did for G prime. So we can convert any algebraic type of attack on G prime to an attack on G. Now, for differential cryptanalysis, we computed the bounds for the elastic versions of AES and the elastic version of MISTI 1. For differential cryptanalysis, the probability a differential holds through the round function stays the same because we just use the round function over in G prime. However, in G, if you have a delta going into the round denoted by delta N1 here, and it creates delta out 1 with some probability, well, this delta out 1 is just going to be the delta input to the next round function. Whereas in the elastic version, we get delta out 1 with the same probability, but now we have the swapping of bits here. So unless the delta in the Y bits was 0, delta N2 will not equal delta out 1. So what we need to do is view the data block as a delta B bit portion and a delta Y bit portion and determine the possible impacts of the swap step. Specifically, we define states saying, well, was the delta B portion 0 or non-zero, and or is the delta Y portion 0 or non-zero? And we track how these states propagate through the rounds. Now, for AES, we used a computer model to do this. And as we started tracing through states, every time we got to a point where a differential characteristic held with a probability that precluded a differential attack, we stopped and then moved on to tracing through the next state. And we end up showing that a differential attack is not possible in the elastic version of AES, which makes sense because it's not possible in AES, and from our general result, that would apply differential cryptanalysis is not possible in the elastic version. And for MISTI 1, we defined the states, and it was possible to do that through a paper or pencil analysis. Okay. So to summarize, we have a method for creating variable-length block ciphers that will produce a workload that's proportional to the block size when encrypting the data. It's a combination of a design from scratch and black box approach, and we're able to relate the security of the elastic version to the original cipher, so we don't have to analyze it from scratch when dealing with practical attacks recovering the key bits. A couple other results that we have are it's possible to use the variable length blocks to define new modes of encryption. And if the round function itself is a fixed length PRP, we can create variable length PRPs and FPRPs from this. And to cover all possible values of Y, it takes 5 rounds of the elastic version to create a variable length SPRP. And that's it. Yes?
So can you comment again, what is the tightness of the security reduction when you're moving from adding exactly from the dashboard? In other words, how does an attack get the elastic constraint on the underlying cipher, and as the length of the key grows,
So the first method is just a direct conversion in linear time. So it's not a I guess I can't say whether it's a tight. I can't categorize it in terms of tightness because it really is just a direct practical conversion. Here's the key for G prime. You convert them directly into key for G. We do this by if you have plain text hypertext pairs for G, it's possible to append bits to them, and so they now B plus Y bits. And the easiest thing that we were able to do is append zeros to the plain text and create plain text hypertext pairs for G prime, such that when you find the keys for G prime, they're going to be consistent with the keys used to process convert P to C when encrypting with G. Now, all we're doing here is literally a direct conversion of the key bits from G prime to G. So I'm not sure, I mean, it's either there's an attack on G prime, in which case you definitely find the keys, or there's no attack on G prime and you don't find the keys.
I'm not sure about this. It's a direct conversion. You're not using
No, it's literally a direct conversion.